Our hills are buffaloes. Our buffalo hills. We have a beautiful mother. Our oceans are wounds. Her wounds, oceans. We have a beautiful mother. Her teeth, a white stone at the edge of the water. The summer grasses, her plentiful hair. We have a beautiful mother.
And that was, we have a beautiful mother, obviously, and this is a shout-out to Mother Earth. Around the San Francisco Bay Area, at least, in Alameda County, there's going to be a lot of Earth Day events on Saturday, April 26th, and that particular excerpt of Alice Walker's poem was a part of Jennifer Berezon's 2005 Praises for the World. And we are joined in the studio by David Minkus and Jennifer Cadova. And David's going to be telling us about a wonderful symposia next week, which is free for everybody. So hopefully you'll be able to call in today so you can get a free lunch, or by Sunday to get a free lunch. And it, 2014 marks the 35th anniversary of graduate training at the Institute for the Study of Social Change, now the Institute for the Study of Societal Issues. And for the past three decades, ISSC, or I, has provided mentorship, training, and support to numerous doctoral students who have gone on to produce social change scholarship that transforms the world and the academy. In recognition of this anniversary, this one-day conference, which is Friday, May 2nd, 8:30 to 4:30 at UC Berkeley, will feature presentations by alumni of the graduate training program, now distinguished academics, whose groundbreaking work on stratification and social change in United States cities challenges the presumptions of power and the powerful. So it's going to be simply fantastic. So David Minkus, PhD, and Teresa Cadova are going to talk about that. But first we're going to have David sort of give us some of the scope and the background of the program on its 35th anniversary. And David is the director of Great Cities. Oh, no, actually, no, that's Teresa.
That's Teresa.
yeah, David is a graduate fellows training program coordinator. And Teresa is going to talk about the Great Cities Institute, where she is director. And she is also professor of urban planning and policy at the University of Illinois at Chicago. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So let's start off. You know, the thing about history and time passing in our own families and our communities is, you know, sometimes we lose our way and things have changed, but we don't really know what we've gone through. And part of the whole change in social sciences and cultural studies and social theory and a whole range of other emergent new ways of looking at people's social lives is people are looking for new ways to think about their place in history and their place in their past and in their future. And so this conference is coming at a time when it's the 35th anniversary of the training program. And the training program really began out of kind of a dual impetus that there were all kinds of demonstrations in that period around civil rights, greater gender equality, and also people were concerned with the organization of the university and what its goals were. And in the context of that, while there had begun to be some change in who was at the university, for the most part within the graduate schools of the University of California, there were very few people of color. And there were not very many white women in the social sciences either. So the training program kind of emerged over a couple of stages as a response to trying to bring more social inclusion and social equity of who was there in the room, and then bringing new concerns about what we should be studying. What are the right problems that deal with creating more social justice and positive redistributions of control over people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a really important way, I think, to frame why this symposium is happening. And one of the things that came out of all those struggles were these foundational principles. That was one thing. And then the second thing were then people in place to carry out some of these principles. So some of those principles, for example, were about the value of education in being able to then serve the communities from which we came. So this whole idea of social change was about using our education to make a difference where it mattered, in particular our communities. So the kinds of things that we were concerned about were the things that were affecting the day-to-day lives of our communities. So here we are now 35 years later, and in those last 35 years, there's been a lot of changes with respect to the economy and the impacts of that economy on our families, on our households. And now more than ever, we really need to think about those foundational principles, those foundational values by which we connect our lives, our work in the university, with the needs of our communities.
So let's let me read your bios, and you can talk a little bit about the work that you've been doing, and then we could talk about some of the areas of work that your various presenters are going to be sharing at the conference next week. So I'll start with you, Teresa, and then I'll go back to you, David. So, Teresa, you are, as already mentioned, Director of Great Cities Institute and Professor of Urban Planning and Policy at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and as an applied theorist and political economist, you approach your work as a scholarship engagement in which research, pedagogy, and service are integrated. Your analysis of global local dynamics, including impacts of globalization on Latino communities, informs your publication in Community Development in Latino Studies. Throughout your career, you have engaged in communities outside the university, and you're an expert in community-university partnerships. You are former elected and appointed member and or chair of national, regional, and local boards, commissions, and steering committees of county government, community development corporations, grassroots organizations, editorial boards, research centers, planning organizations, policy groups, civic and advisory councils, federal agencies, and campus committees. You've been instrumental in affecting economic development policy and projects, and the provision of infrastructure, local governance, and neighborhood change. You're president of the board of the Praxis. Oh, I know the Praxis. So you know
McConney.
Yes. Oh, mm-hmm. You're president. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to get McConney on to talk about the Praxis project yet.
You should, actually. Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful organization.
Oh, why don't you start with the Praxis Project and then tell us some names of some of these organizations that you don't name that you're a part of. It's like, okay, but what federal agency, what campus committee, what research center, what planning organization, what policy group? So what is
all
this?
Well, that would be
do?
A longer conversation probably. Well, did you want me to comment on some of those?
Yes, you could sort of tie back into sort of how you took your theoretical training at UC Berkeley and apply it in all of these concrete ways. Maybe you can give us some examples of theory into practice, which sounds like that's a real thrust of the institute.
Well, I guess maybe I can speak to a couple of things. One would be a theory of social change and how we understand the way that change occurs. So while at Berkeley, for example, I did think very consciously about how social change occurs. There were courses on that. That was a regular part of the conversations that went on at the Institute for the Study of Social Change. So once you get a sense of how things change and you understand that the various structural factors, the dynamics of processes, what are the different dimensions, whether it's the economic, the fiscal, the political, the geographic, the geologic, the whole array, the cultural kinds of dynamics, And then the ways in which the processes, the way, you know, once you get in there and try to actually make a difference, how those things get played out, and who are various actors, what are their, how do they view their own stakes on that, for example. Then you, and then once you think about how change occurs, how policy gets made, how a land use decision gets made, how a community is developed, then from there I thought about, okay, what would then be a theory of social action? In other words, how do I see myself as an actor who might engage then in the ways in which social change occurs in order to make a difference? So with that theory of change adapted to a theory of social action, it then has gone on to inform the ways in which I have engaged in then those various research centers, planning organizations, grassroots organizations, community development corporations, and so on, as well as even a policymaker. So I very much attribute my ability to do those kinds of things to the kind of training and the kind of experience and the kind of people I was around when I was at the Institute for the Study of Social Change. It was a very rich intellectual environment. There were some wonderful people who themselves were engaged in social change. And that added to values that I came in with about why I wanted my education to be relevant, why I wanted my education to be meaningful, just beyond myself and beyond itself, right, and to make those kinds of connections. So over the years, I have then engaged in various ways, and so that's why I refer to it as a scholarship of engagement. That's not my term. Mm-hmm. That's a term. That's a term that I've adapted from the field of planning and from the department where I was. What were you going to say, David?
In your work and in the program, there's really, when you talk about engagement, there's two things. There's like changing the flow of information and power, so that one thing is mm-hmm. to get the university into the community, because mm-hmm. the university would have its theories or its research pedagogies, but they wouldn't necessarily be embedded in the community or in the everyday lives and practices of the people in the community. And then the whole goal of the training program when it started was to bring more people from the communities into mm-hmm. the university, and mm-hmm. that would both lead to more inclusion and more prospects for their individual lives, but the collective idea of where things should go, we believed it would change when new people came inside from different social experiences and histories.
You know, I think that's exactly right. And it did make a difference. It did matter. That program did make possible for many of us who came from community to come to the university, and then to, as David says, not only build opportunities for our own lives, but then to actually make a difference, not only in the world outside the university, but in the university itself. I mean, our presence in the university changes the kinds of questions that we ask, the kinds of methodologies that we use, the kinds of theories that we develop. So it's important, I think, again, 35 years later, as the world has changed so much, that we remember those kinds of values, but that we remember also the context and the dynamics of that context in which we are living right now. And if we don't understand, for example, what's going on politically, economically right now, we're at a real disadvantage. If we don't understand, for example, first of all, the fact that we don't have enough jobs in our communities. And if we don't understand the reason why we're not having enough jobs, we then are not in a position to talk about, well, what's it going to take to create jobs? What do we need to do to make it possible for people in our communities to have better quality of life? Because we know that inequality is increasing. We know that poverty has increased. We know that families are having a harder time. The rich are getting richer and more powerful, and everybody else is struggling. And those issues matter. So those of us who came into the university in a critical mass 35 years ago, 30 years ago, and since then, you know, we have a responsibility and we have an opportunity. But I think it really becomes important to reflect on that history as a way to remind people who are just coming into university now about this very important mission. Because for us, it is a mission, it's a vocation. It's something very deeply embedded in our hearts and in our souls. And it really motivates and guides every action, everything we do. And it's that kind of passion, I think, is what we need, it's what we have to have in order to do this very difficult kinds of work. Difficult, yet rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, David. In reading your bio, you've been at the you've been at the Institute for more than 3 decades, and you're currently engaged in preliminary research on access to employment and training within the informal economies of Latino ethnic enclaves. Over the past 15 years, you've worked in research, training, and consultant positions involved in design and evaluation of programs targeting at-risk youth and their families in school, after school, and community settings. You completed a 1-year study of best practice among youth serving programs in Berkeley, 2003-2004, for the city of Berkeley. And you're also principal author with Michael Omi of an evaluation of the young entrepreneurs at Haas School of Business and a program for Bay Area school students. And my daughter was one of the first graduates of the young entrepreneurs programs. She's getting married tomorrow.
Is that where I would know your name?
Yeah, Tessine Sabir, yeah, is my daughter. Yeah, yeah, and she's, you know, she's been using those principles that she learned at the Young Entrepreneurs
Program.
So,
you know, that's
now that she just works for herself completely. She doesn't work for anybody else.
So that program, and then some of the programs, like I was in a lot of schools in San Francisco, mostly middle school, and middle school I was in for the longest period of observation. And what's interesting when you look at these schools or community organizations is trying to figure out, well, why do the ones that survive or work, why are they surviving and why are they working? I mean, nothing's working all the way. You know, you're always fighting your vision. But how is it that the ones that work, work? And you see that, you really see in some of the schools where there were really a big links between the school and the people in the neighborhood around there, the churches that were close by and so on. And in other places, you'll see the people in the who are kind of the social services for the school, counselors and so forth, dealing with a population with a fair amount of immigrant students. They become aware of the needs of the families and the parents and start doing all kinds of informal referrals so that when the process works, the different organizational worlds, which are inclined to be separate, are knitted together by people who are using their networks and their history and experience to get people the services and kinds of experiences that they need, or housing, employment,
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I found it really interesting that you are also engaged in extensive research on travel behavior and social impacts of transportation systems within the Bay Area. And you're principal author of a variety of studies of travel behavior patterns and barriers to use of public transportation, which has really been cut a lot in the past 30 years. And these include studies of the impacts of BART on Bay Area lifestyles and social institutions, the Golden Gate Park Users Transportation Surveys, and the San Francisco Downtown Shoppers Survey. And you're principal author of the Market Feasibility Study for the Muni Market Street Historic Rail Cars. So why don't both of you all talk about you know, something specific, you know, that you have worked on of the things that I've, you know, read about you from your bio, and talk about maybe how you came to UC Berkeley 30 years ago or so, you know, as undergraduate or graduate students, and, you know, with, I don't know if you already had an idea in mind of what you wanted to do with the year scholarship, but sort of how that might have shifted and changed as you looked at, as you mentioned, Teresa, the theory of social change and how you know these systems, you know, usually government systems and informal systems, you know, impact, you know, the people within the society and how you can be an actor in that and sort of shaping the change.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I guess it was 35 years ago, just about when I got to Berkeley. And the thing that motivated me, that drew me to Berkeley, is that I wanted to understand why was there poverty, why was there inequality. And interestingly enough, last evening here at the Great Cities Institute, University of Illinois at Chicago, we had this, it was a magnificent event because of the people we had there and the quality of the conversation. But we had Bob Herbert, a former New York Times columnist and award-winning journalist, we had him speak on the topic of poverty. And then we had a panel of people, various community folks, sort of address some of the issues. And, you know, one of the things that came down to, of course, was a discussion of jobs and how do we build jobs, how to create jobs. So I think I have all these years, I think I have, I do have a pretty good understanding about why inequality exists and why poverty exists, but we're still left with the difficulty of, it's gotten worse, not better, and what are the kinds of policies we need to put in place to be able to make a difference. So some of the things that I'm particularly interested in is youth entrepreneurship and how do we build opportunities for young people, especially young adults who've been locked out of the formal labor system. How do we create opportunities? How do we work alongside them for them to create opportunities for themselves to provide local goods and services in their communities, which not only builds up the strength of their neighborhood economies, but also gives them opportunities to be able to make money and have self-employment as a strategy for their own creating their own household wealth. So that's something that I'm partnering with some folks here to build some opportunities around that. So that would be an example, I think, of how all these years some of the same things continue to be important to me and continue to be things that I work on.
And I think the challenge is the same things continue to be important and the same problems of trying to make change continue. So, one thing that's interesting in terms of creating jobs and training that people need, in the early 1980s, the Institute functioned as a liaison between the city when Gus Newport was mayor and some of the small business community, especially the restaurants and some people in the food industries. And there were all these meetings to try to plan to create a bigger city market near the waterfront, possibly, and a culinary academy. And it's one of those things where people thought it was a great idea, but like many great ideas, it got hung up on some, conflicted interests, or if people saw they needed the land for different things, limited budget, so on. But I think that part of Teresa's experience, like what you were a supervisor, or what we call a supervisor, you are a county supervisor. And then you also were heavily involved when you were first creating your community classes in Albuquerque at University of New Mexico, of using the neighborhood, the community, as a school. So you have your students get involved with doing research, but where they had to go into the community to get some of their data and to talk to people and so on.
Well, some of those projects involved infrastructure, road design, providing a water supply to a community that didn't have it, but not just providing it, but providing it under the conditions that the community wanted to see it, right? So things like level of service and so on. So, a whole slew of infrastructure projects, a small business incubator, affected land use decisions, economic development policies, and so on. And it was an example, really, of students being very engaged and working alongside communities and bringing the skills that they had and combining those with skills and knowledge, and then combining those with the knowledge and desires of and visions of people in the various communities. I think that's part of the legacy too that we get from Institute for the Study of Social Change.
Yeah, I was just noticing, Teresa, you sent me an addendum to your bio, and you mentioned that while you were, you have a PhD in sociology from the University of California, Berkeley, in 1986, but while you were at Berkeley, you were on the city of Berkeley Planning Commission, and among your activities as student activists in the 80s, you worked at the Graduate Assembly, and you were active in the anti-apartheid divestment from the South African movement, and you co-founded the Empowering Women of Color Conference, which is still going strong. Which is like, that is really awesome.
Yeah, I'm really very proud of that of the Empowering Women of Color Conference. That was a conference that started out of a class that I taught, and the title of the class was empowering women of, see, it was issues and actions, no, it was empowering women of color, issues and actions, and affirmative action. And so the topic was around affirmative action, but the core of it was really about building the power of women of color. And so it was part of a larger effort to build the power of women of color, right? Because we had, you know, we had people of color, we had white women, but what about women of color? We often got left out of that dichotomy. So and at that time, you know, people like Carrie Mae Weems was one of the people that helped with that first conference. You know, she now has she has a exhibit right now at the Guggenheim, and we knew Beth Banker would be somebody that was
really
going to rock out. Yeah, and then Lupe Gallegos was somebody who was involved, and she's still working there at Berkeley. Roberta Orola Cordova is a professor at Cal State Northridge, and so one of the things, and Jin Tang, I don't know where she is, but she was one of the original people out of that class as well. And it was typical of how I do my classes, which is to always have projects come out of the courses themselves. So even to this day, I always have students working on something very concrete. But it was one of the things I did through the graduate assembly is to institutionalize the conference so that it would carry on. And so I'm really happy that 30 years later, the conference still exists and still brings women of color together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Awesome. So David, tell people how they could find out more information about the Institute for the Study of Societal Issues, and as this conference, how they can, you know, find out about it and also register so that they can be present. I mean, it's a free conference, but, you know, so far we have to tell people where it is.
Everyone's listening to you on the web. I figure they can get to the web door. The web door for the Center for Research on Social Change is crsc.berkeley.edu. And you'll get to a similar place for the Institute for the Study of Societal Issues. The address is issi.berkeley.edu. And by telephone, the landline, area code 510-642-0813.
Oh, that's the same number, isn't it?
Oh, the same number as what?
As you've had for a long time.
Yeah, right. I was wondering, whose same number?
Yeah.
So, you know,
so go ahead.
What's interesting, you're saying, you asked Teresa about what she does and how's it connected to the training and the history. Well, if you look at some of the people who are presenting, like Victor Rios is presenting partly based on his research, particularly with boys who are getting in trouble at school or with the law in the community. Mm-hmm. But when he was a graduate student, he was working with me on those evaluations of Berkeley community organizations, particularly the ones targeting youth. And, you know, when he was a younger, supposedly more troubled youth, he was in the gang prevention suppression parts of those neighborhood organizations when he'd moved to go Berkeley High to get away from gang stuff in Oakland. So, and now he's an associate professor at University of California, Santa Barbara. So, you know, it's like that wasn't so long ago. He was a grad student 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, talk about some of the other panelists, because it's pretty impressive, and then also some of your speakers, because we haven't told people exactly sort of what's going to be happening, you know, next Friday.
Well, Troy Duster is going to kick it off with a keynote speech,
mm-hmm.
and we know that'll be exciting.
Yeah, who's Troy Duster, for those who don't know him?
Troy Duster is the founder of the Institute for the Study of Social Change. He's... You know, and this whole training program really was his brainchild, and he's been a mentor, I think, probably to everybody, almost everybody. He and David have been really key to providing the training, right? But he's a professor, retired professor from sociology, And for a while, actually, went over to NYU. He was there for about 10 years as a professor there. And so he's Professor Emeritus. He's written very important books throughout the years, most recently one called Backdoor Eugenics, which is a really important book given sort of the technology and the ideology around genetics research. So he continues to travel around the world and play a very key role in challenging some of the research around genetics. Dave, I don't know if you want to add to that.
You're doing pretty well right there.
Wonderful guy.
You know what?
You must come in here, Troy Duster Speak.
Yeah. Right. And if you talk about some of the other people, like the panel that is at 1 to 2:30, Race in the Material World, well, the three speakers and the moderator, they each have a different perspective based on their research that shows the ways in which, you know, one of the things that people have become focused on in the last, you know, 5-10 years, it came through ethnic studies, American studies, ethnic studies, history, how is it that we know that the narratives about what we're doing here and where we've been and where we're going are important, but where do the narratives that we have come from, and how do you change the narrative? And one of the ways that people focus that is talk about what do we remember and what do we forget?
Mm-hmm.
And which types of knowledge and cultural experience are embodied in our social relationships? And in some cases, like Maxine Craig talked about during the movement in the 60s, that hair and clothes and music, those were all part of the movement in the South in the United States. And so the panel that's at 1 to 2:30 is looking the ways in which race becomes embodied both in terms of people's relationships and hierarchies, but also in terms of, like Willow Lung-Amen, she talks about how communities that were seen always in the past as kind of white suburban communities that grew up partly to get away from the inner city in the current period, like around Silicon Valley, those communities are now being filled with new residents who are a large percentage of South Asians and East Asians who are high-tech workers and well-paid and are buying up houses. In some cases, they're buying up houses, tearing down those houses and building a bigger house. So her work, like, addresses the way people deal with the question about who's allowed to make up to change the community, and the big reaction in some places like Fremont to Chinese tearing down houses to build bigger houses after other people have been tearing down houses to build bigger houses. So the show, there's going to be a show there. It's going to be live.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you don't have to pay. You just got to dial in. Dial yourself in, just say you're coming. And there's a seat, and there's food being served at lunch, not to mention.
Yeah, that should be really awesome.
Wisdom with many flavors, and we hope that there's a fever of naturalism that people's getting connected. Because, you know, when these events work, they work for what people do who are presenting and walking around. But they tend to be a time for people to connect with new people and to renew relations that they might have had from before that they hadn't seen people for a while. So it is really an opportunity to be part of this kind of portable community.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's going to be very exciting. And the organizers have done a great job of pulling it together. So I think it's going to be pretty tight, pretty good.
Oh, excellent. Well, I want to thank both of you, David and Teresa, for joining us to talk about, you know, this wonderful, wonderful organization and this great conference that's coming up just 1 week from today. It's really awesome. So people definitely need to plan on being at Breaking Barriers, Building Community, 35 Years of Training, Social Change Scholars, Friday, May 2nd, 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. You need to register by Sunday for a free lunch, and the event is at the Alumni Hall, 2537 Haste Street, between Telegraph Avenue and Bowditch Street, on the UC Berkeley campus. So it should be really, really phenomenal, and really great that you all have been able to, and everyone else that we're going to meet next week, have been able to sort of keep the fire burning, you know, in times when, you know, the fuel is you know, getting scarce. You know, you find somewhere to keep it going, which is really wonderful. And then you're bringing up young people to, you know, to be fired up as well. That's really, really phenomenal, really great.
Fantastic. Right on. Thank you so much, Wanda.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Looking forward to meeting both of you.
Right on. Okay.
All right.
See you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Good morning, Joyce. How are you? good morning, Joyce. How are you?
Fine.
Good. I'm glad you're able to join us. I know you are, like, super, super busy. Oh, my goodness. You said that you just finished putting together the program for the 33rd Annual Northern California Book Award, celebrating books published in 2013 by Northern California authors. And that wonderful event is going to be, once again, at the San Francisco Main Library Corret Auditorium on Sunday, April 27th. The Corret Auditorium and the Main Library is located at 100 Larkin Street Civic Center in San Francisco, and kicks off at 1 to 2:30 are the awards. People can just say, who's going to get it in the fiction category? Oh, my goodness, who's going to get it in this other category? And then, you know, the Fred Cody Award for Lifetime Achievement is being awarded to Adam Hochschild, a wonderful author, journalist, and historian who's written some wonderful books. And yeah, and then from 2:30 to 4, people can, like, mingle and meet all these great authors. So it's just a wonderful opportunity that you've been sort of at the helm with, of course, a lot of help, but just keeping it going, you know, along with your Poetry Flash newspaper. So why don't you talk about the awards, and then I'll give people a little background about you.
Yes, it's really going to be quite a party. It's an incredible range of authors, and at the forefront, like you said, we're honoring Adam Hochschild, who has just been such a mainstay for the Northern California literary community, and in so many ways. He was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and some of his books that people might remember, like Bury the Chains, Prophets and Rebels, and The Fight to Free an Empire's Slaves, which is just an incredible book, was a finalist for the National Book Award and won our Northern California Book Award for Nonfiction in 2005. And he just has maybe 10 or 12 books just like that, but it'll really be a pleasure to honor him. And we have such a range of books to honor from, oh, my goodness, where to even begin? Cecil Williams and Janice Mirakatani. Janice Mirakatani, who is a former San Francisco poet laureate, and Cecil Williams of Glide Memorial Church, they wrote a book called Beyond the Possible, 50 Years of Radical Change at Glide. It is an incredible joint, really spiritual memoir of their journey. And that's a nominee for Creative Nonfiction, and they are going to be there. And Rebecca Solnit, who's a brilliant writer, The Faraway Nearby. Camilla wrote this love letter to San Francisco called Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco. We have all sorts of a book called Down by the Bay, San Francisco's History Between the Tides. It's really very, very readable, very lively book about this place, and I just I don't even know where to begin. I've sort of begun, but
oh, I can definitely ask you some questions about some of these titles because you've read them all, right?
Well, I've read a number of them. I think it would be, in the time we have, humanly impossible to read every page of every one, which is why we have seven committees reading and studying these books since November. And so it is, it's a process that involves about 30 to 40 people who are part of the Northern California Book Reviewers. And there's one, the poetry selection this year is really astounding. There's one book in particular that comes to mind that I think your listeners might really like to know about. It's by a young San Francisco poet named Roxanne Beth Johnson, and the title is Black Crow Dress. And if any of your listeners have a chance to see this book, pick it up, find out about her online, there's actually a review of this book on the poetryflash.org website. We're an online magazine, and it's really it's a incredible book that is slave narratives, but done in a way that is completely new.
Okay, that sounds awesome. Yeah, also wanted to mention with regards to Adam Hochschild, he.
Yes, he did.
Which people probably, I mean, that book's like, I mean, it's almost like I read it yesterday. That's how present you are with his work when you're in it, and then after you finish, you're still in it.
Right. That's such an important book. It was about, what is the subtitle? A Story of Greed, Terror, and Heroism in Colonial Africa. And that was one of his great efforts. He's done a lot of good work, and he's really been a champion of the underdog, if you will. And he's helped us to understand human character and to see how these things unfold.
I was wondering who is Fred Cody for our audience that might not be familiar with him, since the bookstore, you know, where he celebrated, you know, the written word as well as activists, you know, on Telegraph Avenue, it sits empty, and so people, you know, particularly younger people might not know, you know, sort of his legacy and why, you know, having this award is such an honor for the recipient. Maybe you could give us a little background on Fred Cody.
Absolutely. You're right. I mean, naming this award the Fred Cody Award is one way of keeping his name alive. Because the store, of course, closed in 2006, and what happened was Fred Cody, in 1956, he and his wife, Pat Cody, founded Cody's Books in Berkeley, which became sort of an internationally known meeting place and bookstore, great bookstore, and they encouraged many emerging writers. And he loved to review books. He loved to talk about books. He published his reviews, and he was actually the co-founder of the Northern California Book Reviewers. He and his friend Peter Carroll, the historian and author, wanted an excuse to have lunch more often and to meet and talk about books. And so that's how this whole thing started in about 1980. And then the group, they brought a group together of editors of book reviews and book reviewers, and they started meeting regularly in 1981. And I joined them probably in 82, and been meeting regularly ever since to do this work, to talk about and really closely read these wonderful books by Northern California authors. And Fred passed away in 1983. When he died, we decided to raise money to make an endowment to, you know, have a Lifetime Achievement Award in his honor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really wonderful. And you, you know, your editor of Poetry Flash, Literary Review, and Calendar for the West Coast, and you have poetryflash.org, and you're director of Poetry Flash, and presenter, which is the presenter of the Poetry Flash reading series at Moe's Books now in Berkeley. Before that, it was at Cody's and
Right.
a bookstore in Oakland. The Watershed Environmental Poetry Festival, you're one of the coordinators of that. I think Robert Haas was one of the founders of the Watershed Environmental Poetry Festival and the Northern California Book Awards. You're the chair of the Northern California Book Reviewers, a volunteer association, and your honors include the American Book Award, 1994, National Poetry Association's Distinguished Service to Poets and Poetry Award in 1995, the Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Lifetime Achievement Award in 2006, and June 6, 2009 was named Joyce Jenkins Day by the City of Berkeley. So that's coming
yeah,
up.
Yeah, that was. That was, that was fun. That was wild.
Yeah, yeah. So you have a day, June 6th, that's coming up. and Poetry Flash and Joyce Jenkins received the Lit Quick Barbie Coase Award in 2012. And you're the author of Portal, a collection of poems with an introduction by Carolyn Kitzer, and Joy Road, a chapbook. Your poems have appeared in Parthenon, West Review, Ambush
mm-hmm.
Review, Zizava, Addison Street Anthology, Berkeley's Poetry Walk. So you have a poem in the Berkeley Poetry Walk?
I do.
Nice.
And I love having that poem there, and I'm so grateful for that because it is a poem that I really wrote about working on all of these projects, and it mm-hmm. when I pass it on the street, it kind of gets me through and I hope, I always hope some high school student who's walking by from Berkeley High to downtown is, you know, might trip across that tile and
yeah. So where are you exactly? Because there are a lot of great poetry, you know, in those tiles on the Poetry Walk. So where, you know, sort of give us the geographic sort of location. Give us the, you know, sort of the.
It's near the door of Freight and Salvage.
Okay, okay.
On Addison Street, across the street from the Berkeley Rep.
Okay, great. So
that's
share
where,
the poem with us.
did what?
Share the poem with us.
Oh, sure. I'd love to. It's right. Here it is. The poem that's in the sidewalk is called Piano Man. This is about a Mexican restaurant that really keeps us alive here at the Poetry Flash office and has for many years. It's just down the street. Piano Man. Friday night, beautiful jazz piano at Picante's. Two people in the room, three grubby skateboarders and several ticket holders waiting for their food in the next. The music, simple, yet impossibly lovely, impossibly complicated, pours out of the shiny black spinet. The piano player notices me listening. He can hear me listening. He turns his head slightly to look. I look away to avoid eye contact, because the music is impossibly intimate. How can I tell him that it's okay, that no one but me hears, that I will walk out and down 6th Street and he will be alone, but that he must not stop playing, that he is not alone as long as he sounds, that he means as long as he sounds, that he cannot stop playing, he must not.
Yeah, definitely see how that could keep you going. That's big.
Well, it's a Sunday is the Northern California Book Awards will be a real celebration, and it's about all of these wonderful authors in Northern California, and they're just, it's so rich and so, there's so much depth. I was just at the Los Angeles Times Book Prizes in LA recently, and they were absolutely wonderful, and what a range and depth of books drawn from authors internationally. But I thought, wow, our Northern California Book Awards really stand beside these. Well, the authors and, that live here, that make their homes here, it's so exciting. We really need to take every chance. Every chance we have to see the wealth that we have here and to appreciate it and to learn more about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. I want to ask you a question about your own writing, and then I want to go back to the some of the different areas of writing that the awardees come from. You know, we already mentioned fiction, we have poetry, which you've mentioned, but we also have fiction and translation, which, you know, wow, that's really difficult. And we have poetry, which you've already mentioned. We have general nonfiction. We have creative nonfiction. Then we have children's literature, young readers, and young adults. It's just a nice range. And I'm wondering, over the course of the 33 years of the Northern California Book Awards, have the categories expanded, or were they always such a diverse, broad spectrum of the writing that's happening in Northern California? But the first question was sort of how you sort of came to be a poet.
Gosh, well, when I was in high school, I'd never seen a real poetry book. And one day, I grew up in Detroit, and one day my high school English teacher brought me two poetry books. One was Happy Birthday Death by Gregory Corso. The other one was Live or Die by Anne Sexton. And she said, I think these might belong to you. And that started me on a path, and pretty soon I was dragging my girlfriends, you know, into a corner saying, listen to this poem. And they were going, oh, no, not again. So, you know, I've just sort of always been that in a way, even before I knew what it was. And then I just spent the rest of my life trying to learn more about it. And as far as the category expansion at the Book Awards, it has really expanded. It's amazing. Things like the whole nonfiction category. We used to just have one nonfiction category, but there's been an absolute explosion of publishing in creative nonfiction, memoir, philosophical book-length philosophical musings about one's life and about life in general, that sort of thing, that have really taken off. And it's a lot of what's being published now and a lot of what people want to read and buy now. So we had to break nonfiction into creative nonfiction and general nonfiction. General nonfiction meaning more historical work or work based on books based on research. And then the whole translation explosion, I mean an explosion in a good way, growth, burgeoning happened. The Center for the Art of Translation is a wonderful nonprofit organization in San Francisco that's a real center for translators and for translation events and translation publishing, and they co-sponsor the translation awards and make sure that all the nominees are vetted in their original languages and really carefully study the translations before we even consider them as nominees. So without their help, that wouldn't be possible. But it's amazing how many even wonderful translators of international literature live right here, are part of our community.
Right, yeah. Yeah, some of the titles for the fiction in translation, the Medlis Report by Rabi Jabbar, translated by Kareem James Abu Zaid, from the Arabic. That sounds really interesting. And
yes.
The Art of Joy sounds really wonderful.
Yes. There, the translator of The Art of Joy is going to be at the awards, and the translator of the Medlis Report. He's going to, Kareem James Abu Zaid, he's going to be at the awards. That is a very, it's from New Directions, and that is a real interesting translation. It's really a thriller. It was the 2012 International Arabic Fiction Prize winner. And it's a thriller that opens with a bomb blast that kills the former Lebanese prime minister. And it is based on, it's a thriller tale based around that. And really quite a read. And the author, the Lebanese author of the book, well, he writes in Arabic, is the author of 15 other novels, and he was born in Beirut in 1972. So he's a younger generation. Mm-hmm. And the Art of Joy that you mentioned is a huge novel translated from the Italian that went unpublished for 30 years in English and finally was published in English, and so now people can access it for the first time. And there's some quite some amazing books here, but I can't recommend the poetry list enough. It's a good, Bryn Sato, who has a book called The Palace of Contemplating Departure, is a young poet who has sort of a spiritual bent to her work that is, she has a degree in religious studies and in creative writing, but it's a very worthwhile poetry book by an emerging poet. And Allie Warren, Here Come the Warm Jets from City Lights. It's in the Sister Spit series. That's a much more of a it's almost a neo beat, if you will, with a little edge of surrealism and an edge of streetwise. And Roxanne Beth Johnson, oh my goodness, Black Crow Dress. That is that is going to be a classic. That, and she's also a young poet. I think this might be her second book, but she's really coming into her own.
Nice, yeah. And then, you know, you have Seasonal Works with Letters on Fire and Brenda Hillman. She is wonderful.
She is wonderful. And the thing is, you know, she wrote four books of poems based on the elements, water, air, earth. And this one is based on fire. It's the last one in her four books of poetry on the elements. But it's kind of, you know, loosely in a very kind of poetic license kind of way based on fire. But it's got some, it's really kind of radical, I'm telling you, activist radical thoughts in here and expressions of what a poem can do in terms of environmentalism, talking to your congressman. she has poems about drones and what to do and how to think about that. I mean, she doesn't tell you what to think about it, but she describes her own process of trying to come to grips with these things that we have to deal with in our society. And mixes that all up with her sort of whole new way of looking at the nature poem and climate change and what is nature and how does a poet write about nature in a completely non-sentimental, real, authentic way, mm-hmm. with her own irreverent sparkle. So yeah, it's
she's really great. You know, she and her partner, you know, Robert Haas, they make a great team. Is she still
they make
that,
a great team. Of course, he was former.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, I just meant he was the former U.S. poet laureate, and
yes, he sure
was the first U.S. poet laureate from the West, and really. You know, done a lot of activism through art. Were you going to ask about Brenda?
No, yeah, and, you know, he also, you know, was one of the founders of the Watershed poetry event that we mentioned in your bio. And
yes.
And also the Lunchtime Poetry Series at UC Berkeley that's been going strong for many years, where he brings in poets from the different disciplines. I mean, they might even be poets, they might read someone else's poem, but bringing poetry to the UC Berkeley community as an institutional norm, which is really wonderful. But yeah, I was wondering, my other guests are in the studio, so I'm going to have to go in a minute, but if she's still at St. Mary's.
Yes, she is. She's a professor in the master's program, the MFA program in creative writing at St. Mary's College in Moraga.
Right,
and I believe she was one of the founders of that program.
She really is.
So she's done a tremendous a lot, again, for Northern California Letters. And just to say really quickly, obviously all of these people can't read at the awards. That would just be, we'd be there for 2 weeks. But the winners of each category, all the nominees will be honored, and the winners in each category will give a very, you know, will give remarks and read a little something. So you will get a taste of exactly what they do there, besides having a good party.
yeah, and we didn't get a chance to talk about the wonderful children's literature and the young adults, because Freak Boy by Kristen Elizabeth Clark sounds really interesting.
Oh, it's incredible. It's really powerful, and it's really unusual. It's groundbreaking. It's about a transgender youth who doesn't know, I mean, you know, is unsure about, before obviously any kind of transition has taken place, but as a young teenager dealing with that knowledge. It's groundbreaking, and it's written in verse. It's a novel in verse.
Wow, That should be really awesome.
Yeah.
So we are we're speaking with Joyce Jenkins about the 33rd Annual Northern California Book Awards, celebrating books published in 2013 by Northern California authors. This Sunday, April 27th, at the San Francisco Main Library Corrette Auditorium, 100 Larkin Street in Civic Center, San Francisco. That's the Powell. No, that's the Civic Center BART.
Civic Center, yeah.
BART station, and you just come up on the side that's Burger King, and you can't miss it. It's right across the street.
Right.
And 1 to 2:30 p.m. Are the awards, where you get a chance to hear a little bit of all of the writers that you know, actually were nominated, but actually got the prize, and then you can meet everybody because a lot of people are going to be there because no one knows until Sunday who got the award. And then from 2:30 to 4:00, you can hang out and meet the authors and buy their books and eat some little nibbles in the Latino Hispanic meeting room, and it's just all free. So it's like, oh my goodness, can't lose there. So it's really
right.
fun. And, yeah, and thank you, Joy, so much for keeping it going, you know, all these years. With
thank
help,
you,
of
Wanda.
But
thank
you're
you
like
for
the
keeping
one.
It.
Oh, well, thank you. And definitely going to make sure that I can be more active participant next time. But I'm really happy that it keeps on going, keeps on rolling along. And I'm definitely going to walk by your poem, my friend
okay.
Savage, and be encouraged.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for keeping it going, and see you soon, I hope.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to try to sneak away from my papers and get over there, because I really want to meet Adam Hochschild, because you always have such great winners of the awardees of the Cody Award, and he is just so honorable, and I really want to shake his hand.
Yes.
All right, you take good care. Thank you so much, Joyce. You have a good day.
Thank you.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You.
Peace and blessings. Good morning, Peter. Are you there yet?
Yes, I am, Wanda. Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Uh-oh.
Ooh,
we have
a lot of echo.
Okay, let's see. And is Antina?
Yes, I am.
No echo there. Good. And we have a third person. And I'm not certain who that person is.
That's Ryan.
Ryan's
here. Do you hear me? There's a horrible echo. Mm-hmm. I hear the echo.
Okay. So Leontine. There's no echo.
Okay. Wanda, why don't you tell Leontine and I'll call back? How's that? Maybe that'll help. I'll call right back. All right. I'll do the same.
Sure. Let's try that. Okay. Leontine?
Yes.
Oh, super. No echo. No, yes, there is.
Oh, there is as well. I can't hear it at all.
Leontine, why don't you talk this new production, Much Ado About Nothing, while I figure this out.
Okay. Well, first of all, Much Ado About Nothing by Shakespeare, a nice little romantic comedy being performed by African American Shakespeare Company. We open on May 3rd, and we perform on Saturday evenings at 8 and Sunday at 2, every weekend in May, closing on, I think it's Mother's Day on May 25th, on the last Sunday in May. So that's 4 weeks that you get a chance to come and be delighted. Peter has set it, Peter Callender, who's the artistic director of the company and the director of the show, he has set it May 1945. He just won the war, World War II, and the boys are coming home. And so it's just time for celebration, and we certainly do that. We party and have fun and spar. It's a story about love, as I said, it's a romantic comedy, and it's about two, basically it's kind of focused on two different couples, one who's kind of older and wiser, and if anyone has seen His Girl Friday, they have that sort of like bantering, hardcore bantering going on, and then another is a younger, sweeter, softer couple. And the show called Much Ado About Nothing, and as Peter has taught us, that noting is how nothing was pronounced in Elizabethan times. So it's a show about watching people and misconceptions and mistakes and people misinterpreting things and getting mixed up and the consequences of that. So, but everything gets resolved in the end, and we all dance happily at the end of it.
I think I'm back. I'm not sure.
Let's see. You'll have an echo.
It's really bad.
Yeah.
I can't hear
it. Well. So, Peter, why don't you talk as director about play? And your vision
and
for
your
it.
Vision for it.
It's hard to talk with this echo on that. I'm so sorry. I keep hearing myself in my ear.
Oh, that's
I will do my best. The concept for the play, as Lantine said earlier, it takes place in 1945, just after the war. The soldiers are coming home. And as Lantine said earlier very well, it's about what people see or think they see. It's a play about noting. It's a play about deceit and counterfeit. And basically what you do with information that you get, whether it's true or not, what do you do with it? How you react, how you behave after seeing or hearing something that is or is not true, and what you do with that information. And that information can lead to awful misunderstanding, falling in love, falling out of love, shaming other
people.
So what you do with that information is very, very important in life, and the basic theme of the play.
Now,
the play also has great humor. It has great movement, wonderful language. The play is—it's a romantic comedy, one of my favorite romantic comedies, and I think one of Shakespeare's earliest romantic comedies. In the true sense of the word, as we see romantic comedies today, two couples fall in love, two couples fall out of love. Or two couples that don't like each other say they don't like each other. One couple say they don't like each other, but they really do like each other. Certain things happen in between. They fall out of like, they fall back in like. So it has wonderful themes, lots of magic. It's quite a wonderful play, and I think our audiences will thoroughly enjoy it, especially the way I've conceptualized it.
Wow, echo's still happening. Oh, this is crazy. I even tried another phone, and it didn't help.
There was no echo.
So, Ryan.
Yes, Wanda.
Wanda.
Hello, how are you?
So Ryan, go ahead and talk about your character. We're gonna push through this.
Talk about my character.
Yes.
The character's name is Benedict. He's come home from the war.
His war buddies, Pedro, and the rest of them.
And as
Leonardo
says,
which is the owner of the house. He tells people that he had a merry,
a war,
which pretty much gives you a hint about how Beatrice and Benedict were before the war. They were kind of in the same situation. That there's a few things said about how he once gave his heart to her, and there a few things that Shakespeare does not give us a big picture with that, so it's up to us to fill that in. Dick is a jolly, very funny person. He's not like a complete goof or anything, but he's really fun to be around. And his compadres really appreciate that about him, and they looked at him at some points, especially in the play, for relief from the seriousness until things sort of turn around for him.
I've muted myself to cut down on the echoing.
Uh-huh.
So it seems to have worked.
Yeah.
And I muted everybody else too, so that we didn't have the going back and forth. So now I'm going to go back to Peter, and I'm going to mute you. So and then I'll unmute you. So I'm going to try it that way to see if we can like not have.
I can mute myself as well. I can mute myself from here.
Oh really? Okay. All right. Okay. Let's see if I can keep you unmuted. And okay, let's try. Let's see what happens with Peter.
Hey, Wanda.
Hey, Peter. Oh, goody. Oh, it's not echoing. Lovely.
Yeah. Well done. Oh, well done. Good job.
Excellent. Yeah. This technology is crazy sometimes. Okay. Super. I don't know if people got what you said, but I was wondering with regards to this particular work, Much Ado About Nothing, have you directed it before? And actually, have you been in it? Because you're also an actor.
No and yes. I have been in it. I've never directed it. I did it at Cal Shakes a number of years ago. I played Leonardo. I played Hero's father. Leonardo is an incredible character to me. There he is, you know, the father, the governor of Messina, very well loved, very well appreciated, older gentleman, one daughter. He has his niece Beatrice in tow. She's living at the house. She's basically an orphan, but she's living at the house of Leonardo. Very happy home, very wonderful. Nothing is wrong. Messina is a lovely, idyllic place to live. He hears that the Don Pedro, the prince, is coming to visit after the war, and he is thrilled by this. He also hears that Don Pedro has honored Claudio, and his daughter Hero is quite enamored with Claudio. So he arranges the marriage of his daughter to Claudio. He's a very proud, man, and he shows that a lot in the production. And having played him and now directing it, I remember some wonderful things about our production, and I'm adding all kinds of nuances and twists and turns and dynamics to the production as well, which will bring it, I think we will learn something new through this production about the play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And African American Shakespeare Company does a lot of wonderful work in the community. You have school time performances and you've got some other initiatives that you've begun, as artistic director of the company that continue, which, you know, I'm sure is one of the many reasons why, you know, you all are being honored this coming month, as one of, our, prize regional theaters.
We have been honored with the Payne Knickerbocker Award for Outstanding Contribution to Bay Area Theater. And that is wonderful. Payne Knickerbocker was the San Francisco Chronicle critic back in the day. It's an honor to have his name attached to an award, and that award given to the African American Shakespeare Company. We are finally on the table. We're finally at the table. We are now part of the one of the shining stars in the constellation of Bay Area Theater. And we are very, very happy about that. Before we say African America, we can now say the award-winning African American Shakespeare Company.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a major award given to us by the Bay Area Critics Circle Award, which takes place this Monday night Monday, May 5th, in Oakland. So that's really wonderful. And we do have several programs going on. We do have the Shake It Up program with kids in the schools. We have 4 student matinees that the kids attend for free. We do not charge any of the schools to have their students attend our matinees. We just feel that, a lot of funding taken out of California schools for the arts, and most likely sometimes the teachers are the ones that are footing the bill and the schools, and they just can't afford it. So we have these matinees for free. And it also gives our actors an early audience. And we know kids, Wanda. They tell the truth. If they don't like something, we know they don't like it. So they are my test to see what works and what doesn't work in the show. And they usually, by that time, everything is working well, and the kids are going to love it. I'm telling you, they're gonna love this. There's so many antics and fun and buffoonery, and there's the music, of course, of Ella Fitzgerald, which I've chosen a few numbers from Ella to place throughout the play. So it has a bit of everything. I've designed the set myself. It has wonderful color and variety in it. And, of course, the actors that African American Shakespeare Company has chosen for this production. Just a tremendous group of young, talented actors who are very gung-ho about bringing this production to the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there any new actors that are making their debuts at African American?
Yes. One of your guests, Ryan Anderson,
Equity
actor out of Los Angeles. Ryan will be making his African American Shakes debut as Benedict.
Nice.
We have, let's see, who else is making their debut on our stage? I think in this company, in this production, I'm thinking real fast. I think that is it. I mean, Lantine, of course. Medea, her wonderful work in Medea. Monica Cappuccini was also in Cinderella a couple of times. Twan Marcel was in Merry Wives of Windsor. And, of course, Cinderella. Tavia was Merry Wives of Windsor. So most of the actors in the company are veteran actors of the African American Shakespeare Company. I think Ryan Anderson is a new member of the company.
Okay. Let's bring Ryan back on to talk a minute about his character. Hey, Ryan.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, good. Well, no echo. Yes. I want to talk a little bit about how this particular production appeals to today's audience. When one thinks about Shakespeare, a lot of people think, they don't necessarily see the relevance of Shakespeare and Shakespearean theater to today. I was wondering, sort of, what do you tell folks, and how do you get them in the seats? How do you get them in the theater to experience, a play, specifically this one in particular? So how does it appeal? What are some of the themes that run through this particular play that are current and that you think about as you embody your character?
What I think you said is very true, that I was even guilty of before I even started acting, is that Shakespeare is foreign. It's something that we as Americans can't understand, especially young people who never heard it before, and we see it on the page and we hear it and it's like blah, 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 but then you get to the point where if you start to appreciate Shakespeare, not necessarily having to be an actor, but if you appreciate it, you start to understand that there is nothing to be afraid of. It's actually something you can understand very well. Of course, there are mentions to things that culturally that we don't adhere to anymore these days. But aside from that, if someone speaks a thought, whether it's in Shakespeare or Shaw or Wilson, if they speak a thought and they speak it clearly, that thought should be conveyed to whoever is sitting there watching and listening. And I think that just comes down to whether or not the performers are understanding their jobs on stage at the moment, like what they're doing. And I think what we're doing over here at African American Shakes for Much Ado is that we are telling a clear story. It's all up to us to understand exactly what we are doing here on stage. We're setting it, as you know, in 1945, after the war, and that brings it to a more contemporary state, I think, as well, because when the people see, oh, they're not dressed in balloon pants and feathers in their hats, you know, they have army uniforms that we recognize, you know, they have dresses and magazines and flowers and things. I think for people who are not used to it, they'll sit down and say, wow, this is something I can get into. And then from there, it's just about, basically just about letting our words and letting our story just seep into their bodies and into their brains, into their ears, as they just sit back and enjoy, hopefully, you know, our show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you mentioned after the war, and actually there's a play called After the War, and it was mounted at ACT, Peter, what's the name of the author?
Philip Tancatanda.
Yeah, he is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen
Anthony Jones did that at ACT. As a matter of fact, that's going to be remounted somewhere very soon. Stephen Anthony Jones and I, we were talking about that the other day, and I ran into Philip, and he says that will be remounted. So keep an eye out for that, Wanda.
Mm-hmm.
Have him back on your show, talk about that. That was a wonderful play.
It sure was, yes, particularly with
mm-hmm.
the wonderful sound, you know, the music that was composed by Anthony Brown and the Afro-Asian Orchestra. It was
mm-hmm.
really, really beautiful, that story. And it, you know, has, you know, sort of really local, you know, set in San Francisco, you know, during a time when Japanese were being interned
mm-hmm.
and people of African descent were, so they wouldn't lose their homes, were occupying some of those homes until the people came back.
Right.
Yeah, it was a great, great story.
You know,
go ahead. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you said something, you said one word there, and going back to what Ryan just said about our production, you said the word local. And I think that resonates with me, certainly as artistic director, but as director of Much Ado About Nothing. We bring it right, we make it look as if it's happening in your neighborhood. When we did Medea, it was like it's happening in your neighborhood. You can sit in the audience and say, you know, I know somebody just like that. My auntie talks just like that. My uncle walks just like that. And I think when we produce Shakespeare plays or any of the classics at African American Shakespeare Company, I want that in that sense of neighborhood, that sense of local, that sense of I know that person. That person reminds me of so-and-so-and-so. That person is my neighbor. That person looks like my neighbor. And I think if I can get the audiences to think that way, then they will pay attention and they will glean the story. They will glean ideas and contrasts and dynamics from the story itself. Once an audience looks at the play and cannot recognize anybody in it, in themselves, or the play is out of their realm of believability, then I think audiences tap out a little bit. They think about, oh, what do I have to do at home? Whereas if they look at it and see, this is me. I could do that. I understand what he's saying. I understand how Benedict feels about marriage. I know somebody that talks like that. I understand how Beatrice feels about Benedict. Wow, my cousin, da-da-da-da, or my friend, when I was in high school. That's the thing. That's when they get it. And I think as a director, I want to make sure that the actors are telling the story. And as Ryan said so eloquently, understanding what they're saying, how to present it, how to talk on stage, certainly, how to bring it in their character, and then just let it flow, and the audience will pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what excites me when I'm in the house, whether I direct a play or whether it is directed for the company by another director. As I look at the audience, I feel out the audience, are they getting it? Are we telling this story so that it is clear and understandable?
and reimagined and fun as well. And I think that's what we do at African American Shakespeare Company. I think, you know, the Payne Knickerbocker Award says that, yes, we are being acknowledged for that, and that makes me very, very happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to bring Leontine back in the conversation because she, you know, has embodied two characters specifically that have a response to the war in her Medea, as well as now as her current role. And there's our echoes. We could try the muting thing again. So, Leontine?
Yes, hi.
Hi. I'm gonna ask the question and then I'm gonna let you tap it.
Okay.
So, Leontine, why don't you tell us about your character, Beatrice, with regards to, you know, sort of after the war, and maybe draw, if you like, some parallels between your characters, because Medea is quite a different character than Beatrice. They're very different, yet I'm sure you found some similarities within, you know, at least the setting. And then the question that I asked Ryan with regards to how this particular play can resonate with today's audience, wonder if you could respond to that as well. So I'm going to unmute you right now and mute myself.
So while Medea and Beatrice are very different women, I mean, they're in very different times. I think that Beatrice is kind of maybe at the beginning of a relationship. She's poised at the possibility of it, and is kind of fighting, falling off the precipice. You know, I mean, she and Benedict have a history together, which is not in any way described in the play. Obviously, we have an idea of what that is, and so here at the end of the war, it's an opportunity for new things to begin and for new possibilities to be explored, and I'm fighting that because it's a little dangerous, you know. Who knows what hurts might come or what might happen, you know. You know, something like, and Medea is further down the road. She took the plunge. She wholeheartedly and suffered consequences for it. So I think that's kind of the parallel of those two, is that Beatrice is afraid, obviously not that something is drastic as Medea might happen, but there is that danger of committing yourself and letting yourself go and falling into someone else's power in a way, which is what love is in a way, just letting go of that and trusting someone else. Beatrice is a very strong woman, and in that I think she's also kind of similar to Medea. She speaks her mind, and she's a jokester, and she's witty, and she likes to banter, and she likes sort of verbal swordplay and stuff like that. And in a way, like Ryan was saying, that his companions turn to him for you know, comic relief in times of stress. I think that Beatrice kind of views herself as someone who can do that for her family, for hero, for, you know, just entertain them and lighten things up. As far as how the show is relevant to today's audience, I would say this notion of romantic comedy, and when Peter first mentioned this to me, I was like, yes, that's totally true, because it, Much Ado About Nothing really follows the structure of a romantic comedy. It they start off, you meet the couples, they're one of them is all goo-goo eyes, and the other is kind of fine, but you know that they really like each other, and then things go on, and things get nice, and they find an understanding, and then things don't go so well. Like, so that whole arc is followed, and I think that for modern audiences, that is a very recognizable story format. you know, there's nothing foreign about that. So in coming to see Much Ado, you're not setting yourself up for something that is for a play structure that is archaic or arcane in any way. It's very accessible in that way. That is something that we all recognize and enjoy and can just let wash over us with good music and cute couples and laughter and fun and goofiness and, you know, in movies where they have great sidekicks, you know, those sidekick characters are there to add that level of kind of more physical humor. So all of the elements are there, and so it's going will be something that you can flip right into and not feel that it's nothing that you've seen before, except it's just Shakespeare's words and poetry as its format.
Well, thank you, Leontine. And I wanted to give you, Peter and Ryan, we're going over a little bit, but we had such trouble in the beginning. an opportunity to maybe comment on Leontine's, you know, sharing just now about the structure of the play, but also about the various characters. And do you have any sort of favorite scenes or anything you'd like to share with the audience?
Yeah. Am I back?
Yes, you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Leontine did it very well as far as the movement of the play. It is very, very, very much a romantic comedy. And I want to add one thing to what she said, that, yes, Beatrice has these she's in love, she's not in love. She cares, she doesn't care. But and she's a jokester and she's not a jokester. And I think with any kind of comedian or jokester or prankster, there is a very sensitive person, a sensitive, almost shy person behind all of that. And what I love about Beatrice and Benedict and the work that these actors are doing on stage, we see that. We see that they are pranksters, and they love to make people laugh. But when Benedict is referred to as a jester, as the king's jester, he reflects on that. Is that all I am seen as? And he reflects on that, and he reflects on the fact that people think that he's not attentive. He doesn't care about people. He dismisses life. We think he's witty, but we're not sure. And he reflects on that, and he thinks back on that. So these two people, although they make people laugh, and they give and they give and they give, there is that tender heart, and I think that's what brings them together in the relationship. And, you know, talking about funny parts, there are two, I call them the gulling scenes, G-U-L-L-I-N-G, the gulling scenes, in which the first one is Don Pedro, Claudio, and Leonato play a trick, a deceptive trick on Benedict. They pretend to have been told by Hero that Beatrice is madly, madly desirous and in love with Benedict, and she can barely contain herself with this love that she has for him. And he eavesdrops on this conversation. And it's very funny. Ryan has this physical humor and this charm and this he's metamorphic in a sense. He changes from this stern, jovial soldier to this very sensitive schoolboy who discovers that the girl with the pigtails that he's been putting in her ink in the inkwell, she really likes him. And he realizes, oh my gosh, she really likes me. And he goes through this boyish nature that's very charming and very wonderful. And the same thing happens with Beatrice when Hero and Ursula trick her into believing that Benedict loves her. And again, Leontine as Beatrice goes from this, if you remember the Little Rascals from back in the day, the female, you know, He-Man haters club, to this charming, sweet, girlish. Now I need to be pretty. Now I need to be sweet. Now I need, and the transformations are just heartwarming and funny and sensitive. The actors do it so well. The transformations are gorgeous. Those two are two of my favorites. There are several wonderful warm scenes as well. Claudio coming to the chapel where he thinks Hero is in state. The little song he sings and the poetry that he places on her tomb. I mean, these are wonderfully touching, memorable scenes that translate universally to everyone in the house. We've all been there. We've all seen that. We've all been there. We've all been tricked one way or another. With all the TV shows now about pranking and you know, being punked and all that, this play is chock full of all of that stuff. It is so contemporary. It is so right now to our present-day lives, our present-day television watching. It's very, yeah, very funny.
But one would say to a good end, right?
To a wonderful end, yeah. To an end where people realize, you know, that that yes, all is well. I'm sorry to mention another Shakespeare play, but all is well that does end well. Mm-hmm. We realize that as I said earlier, it's what you do with information that you receive. You do the right thing with it, and sometimes you don't, and there's punishment for that. There's a little bit of disgrace. But it's also about forgiving. Once you realize that mistakes were made, things were said that should not have been said, there's what you do with that as well. And at the very end, there's forgiveness. There's coming together. There's Claudio realizes what he's done and atones for his actions, for dismissing Hero at the altar. He atones for that at the very end. And as in most Shakespeare plays, there's hilarity and dance at the end. Benedict says, strike up pipers, and Ella Fitzgerald and her orchestra takes us through an amazing dance, swing dance and curtain call, and the audience will be on their feet. It's just one of those joyous, fabulous endings of a Shakespeare play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was just thinking as you were speaking, Peter, about the title, Much Ado About Nothing, that, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, what is really important? I mean, are we making big things out of nothing? You know, we're
exactly,
like putting our emphasis on this, you know, trifling kind of transitory issue or, you know, wounding of our ego when we could be spending a lot more time loving each other. So why are we making such a big deal out of these things? You know, Shakespeare.
Wanda, I wish I had said that. I wish, with all the talking I've done, I wish I had said that. That is exactly right. It is. We, you know, Don John feels that he has been slighted by his brother Don Pedro, so he is disgruntled and he decides with his little cohorts to throw a wrench in the mechanism to make everybody as unhappy as he is. Beatrice says about Don John, she never sees him, but she's heartburned an hour later. He just brings darkness down because he was wronged at one time. So he feels that he has to do something about it, and that really starts an entire the sad underbelly of the show. So we tend to do that, and you said it so eloquently. We tend to do that instead of realizing what we have and how wonderful we have and how what we can do with all that. And at the very end, we realize that, you know, friendship, brotherhood, sisterhood, family is what's really, really important. And I think if we tell the story correctly, those themes and those motifs will shine through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. So, Ryan, I want to give you an opportunity to comment mm-hmm. on, you know, some of your favorite aspects of the play and also sort of how, you know, how as a black man you came to theater and then Shakespeare, mm-hmm. no less, as a career. And then, Lantine, I want to let you have the final word after Ryan finishes.
Well, first of all, I do want to say that, like what Leontine was saying first is about how it's a recognizable theme. I totally agree with that. I mean, when it comes to love, love can be recognized anywhere. It could be a Chinese fable. It could be an African tale. It could be whatever. And I think we can all recognize that, even if it's told through animals. You know, it's all through action and reaction. And, you know, from elementary school, or maybe even, you know, sooner than that, when we push the girl down at the sandbox and we run away giggling, all that stuff, we all recognize what that is, really, you know, and that's just us in grown-up form, you know, Beatrice and Benedict, you know, they're stabbing at each other, but anyone watching them can see what it is, you know, and they see what it is, but I think they just have too much pride maybe to sort of cut through all of that. And I think one thing that Leontine says in the play, what Beatrice says in the play to Hero, is pretty good advice for herself and for me as well, where, you know, where she says, it's your turn to speak, but, you know, stop, or she says, stop his mouth to Claudio, stop his mouth with a kiss, you know, which is just cutting through all the bull and just getting to the point of it all, you know. One of my favorite moments definitely is what Peter mentioned in the scene. It's just anytime you get a chance to act the fool on stage and just roll around and just be kind of, you know, zany is just a great opportunity. I normally don't get to do that, so this is just really fun. And we have many places in the theater that allow for it. And we, of course, we ask that everyone suspends the disbelief, you know, about things, but it's just a really fun sort of Looney Tunes sort of type of experience in that moment. And then finally, I guess for me, getting into theater, when I was younger, I did not do theater. I was too shy. I didn't have theater in my high school either, so I did not do theater. I got into theater in undergrad while I was studying architecture, a music theater major, and he and I still remain best friends till this day. And for some reason, you know, God put me in that position where he exposed me to performing arts. I used to play saxophone in the performing arts, and I used to draw a lot, so I was very much into the arts. But performing in that way, speaking in front of people, started in undergrad, and then it just kind of flourished from there. And, you know, went to MFA, got my MFA, and then after that, you know, the rest is history. But at this point, you know, theater is in my blood, and it'll be there forever.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, you know, Ryan and Leontine, when I saw you at, and Peter at opening night of Fences, it's a wonderful production at the Marin Theater Company, when Peter introduced you as you know, as Benedict, I'm like, ooh, and you know, Leontine, I'd already known that, you know, her, you know, and she had told me in an interview when we were talking about Medea that she was going to be Beatrice, that the two of you together, it's like, oh, you're such a lovely couple. And then, you know, a stage couple. And then Peter's wonderful photography, if you go to the website for African American Shakes, you can look at some of this wonderful photography. It's just like, oh, this is going to be so beautiful. Like, just if you don't say a word, it's going to be really beautiful. And, of course, we have, you know, you all doing, you know, filling these wonderful roles. So I'm really looking forward to seeing you, you know, on stage next week. Wow! So you open, and then African American Shakes gets this wonderful award that Monday. What a great weekend, huh, Peter?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. I'm so looking forward to it. I really am. Thank you, Wanda.
Yeah, and it's the end of your season too, right?
It is the end of our 19th season, and we are gearing up for our 20th anniversary season.
Oh,
next year, we have two brand new plays coming to our theater, in addition to our holiday fair, Cinderella. And Nancy Carlin, the wonderful Nancy Carlin, who I've worked with at Cal Shakes a number of years, who is a director and a writer and an amazing actress in her own right. She'll be directing our production of The Tempest, which will open our 20th anniversary season, and that will be followed by Cinderella. And then we are doing a brand new play that is being written for us in collaboration with Golden Thread Theater.
a play that will be about the Ellington story, Ellington's visit to Isfahan, Iran, and I'll be playing Billy Strayhorn in that brand new production. The title is still being worked on. And then the fourth production will be Nnamdi E. Kelly's retelling of Antigone's story by Sophocles. It's called Extigone. It takes place in Chicago with poetry and rap and music directed by Rodessa Jones. So we have an amazing, the Ellington story will be directed by Laura Hope. One more thing, the Cinderella will be directed by Margot Hall.
Oh, really?
So we have, so we have an amazing season with stellar directors, and I'm trying to, and I'll keep this from the general public for now, I'm trying to get a local celebrity to come through and work with us this season. So I'm working on that. I'll probably, hopefully make that announcement very, very soon.
Nice, nice. And it's really great that on your 20th anniversary you'll be bringing back The Tempest because African American Shakespeare Company actually had a production of The Tempest on the Barracuda, you know, on the ship.
Right.
Yeah, Sherry Young actually directed that. And that's really wonderful to have that play on the ship. I mean, that's like talk about, you know, setting.
Exactly. I wish that is a dream of mine to do Shakespeare on site. I've been in productions in which Shakespeare has been done on site, and I've seen a number of productions in which Shakespeare on site, and that's a wonderful thing. We'll try to translate that as best we can in our production in October.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's gonna be fun. It's gonna be wonderful. Nancy Carlin is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
She's so smart.
Yeah,
I'm thrilled
yeah.
that she's coming to direct for us.
So now we're going to let Ms. Leontine Mbele Mbong sort of take us out with her reflections on her character, her favorite scenes, and just, you know, being a part of this wonderful theater community here in the San Francisco Bay Area. So, Leontine, I'm going to mute everybody and then let you take us on out of this wonderful interview.
Well, reflections about my character. Well, I just want to say that this has been, like, working with African American Shakespeare Company this season has just been wonderful and so incredibly rewarding. And it's so great to be a part of a company that is working so hard, as Peter said, to, like, to have shows that audiences can come and see themselves in. And it's been a wonderful season for me personally and professionally. Playing Medea was just amazing. And then going from that into Beatrice, who is one of my favorite characters that I've always wanted to play since I fell in love with Emma Thompson playing it in the Kenneth Branagh version. So I'm just grateful that there is a theater company that provides that opportunity. I just had a thought that just evaporated. It's great to be able to do that, and I'm so delighted that they are being honored with this award on Monday the 5th. Here's looking forward to another great 20 years.
I'm back. And yeah, there's the echo. Yeah, Peter, I didn't have to mute you and you didn't echo, so that's kind of interesting. And Ryan, I think you were muting yourself, so you didn't echo either. But so I'm going to just mute myself. You didn't necessarily reflect Leontine, on any of your favorite scenes. So I just wanted to remind you of that, and I'm going to unmute you and mute myself. So.
Thank you. That was the thought that evaporated. So in keeping with that notion of opportunity, one of my favorite things that is coming out of this production is Margaret, who is who plays kind of a, whose character is a servant, and she has this little side love affair with one of the soldiers. And Peter has blocked all these delightful little moments of Margaret getting all flustered and trying to sneak off to meet her beau and all of these delightful little things that aren't written into the show, but that he's seen potential in this actress Tavia, and he's mining that that little side story. So it's just kind of, for me, a sign of everything that the company represents, which is giving opportunity to up-and-coming actors, and it's kind of Peter's creative mind of seeing things and having these ideas that aren't necessarily written on paper, and just coming up with these little things that really flesh out and make so real a show that really puts meat on the bones and curves to the figure of the play. So that's one of my favorites, and it's kind of the embodiment of everything that kind of African American Shakespeare Company represents.
Yeah, I'm unmuted,
and I'm trying.
It's not working.
It's not working.
Okay, sorry, Leontine. For some reason, when we're all in together, we have echoes. So Peter and Ryan and Leontine, I want to thank you all so much for joining us today to talk about this wonderful closing season, 19th season.
Yeah.
Production. Wow. I mean, it's amazing to be around 19 years. I mean, I think, you are the only black theater company, equity black theater company in the San Francisco Bay Area, right?
Right. We are the only producing company. Lorraine Hansberry, Stephen Anthony Jones's company is still around. They are doing readings and producing at venues around the Bay Area, but we are the only producing company at this moment until Lorraine Hansberry Theater gets itself back on its feet, and we are holding the fort. We are letting people know that we are still there, that African American theater is still strong in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we're very very
good.
Proud of that.
Yeah, yeah, I'm really happy you're holding it down as well. I remember when African American Shakespeare Company didn't have a home, but the founders, Sherry, kept, they did a lot of things at Mills College and that theater, outdoors at your Wellness Center for the Arts. I saw some great plays in the garden. And then now to be one of the anchor tenants, at the African American Art and Culture Complex, in the Burial Clay Theater is just so wonderful. How long have you been there at the Burial Clay in the African American Art and Culture Complex?
I think it's going on 8 years.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I know we when I first saw the African American Shakespeare Company, it was at the Alice Arts Center. It was a production of Pygmalion that Sherry was in, as a matter of fact. She played Eliza Doolittle.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's been about 8 years since the company has been at the Burial Clay Theater. And what Sherry has done over the past 19 years is beyond amazing to have kept it going for so long. And now, finally, it's all her work is just coming to fruition, and she is amazing in my eyes. She has done wonderful things with this company, and she's given me the opportunity to help her with her vision and to bring in talents like Ryan and Lantine and Tavia and Monica and to have stage managers come in like Cheryl Honolar, who is an amazing stage manager, and Bert Van Allsburg, who is designing and building our sets, to get these artisans working with our company and loving to work with our company and creating such wonderful work. I feel very blessed, and it just motivates me to keep going and getting these young actors, and well, not just young actors in the Bay Area, give them a chance to play these amazing roles and do it so well. It's a blessing, and thank you so much for what you do, Wanda, and as your former guest said, your earlier guest said, for keeping it going. I think you're doing a wonderful job as well, so we all thank you very, very much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I'll let our audience know that Much Ado About Nothing opens Saturday, May 3rd, 8 p.m., and it continues Saturday and Sunday, Saturdays at 8 and Sundays at 3 through Sunday, May 25th, at the Burial Clay Theater at the African American Art and Culture Complex, 762 Fulton Street at Webster in San Francisco. And for tickets, which range from $12.50 to $37.50, it's like, oh, my goodness, what a deal. Opening night, mm-hmm. 25 to 50, groups of 10 plus can get a special discount. And they have the student matinees. For all the information, you should visit the website, African-AmericanShakes.org. And you can also make phone calls for information and tickets at 800-838-3006, 800-838-3006. And again, African-AmericanShakes.org is where all the information is about Much Ado About Nothing and all the other wonderful programs that African-American Shakespeare Theater is involved in year-round.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Wanda. And just so the 38th Annual Critics Circle Awards Gala on May 5th is at the California Ballroom, 1736 Franklin in Oakland. So that's on May 5th. So you can just go on their website. There are about 30 to 40 tickets left. It's almost sold out. So if your listeners can call right now, 1-800-838-3006, 1-800-838-3006, and grab the last few tickets. It's going to be celebrating Bay Area theater in general, but African-American Shakespeare's winning of the Payne Knickerbocker Award for Outstanding Contribution. We're very happy about that.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And I don't know if that many African-American theaters have been awarded in the past, so it's historic.
Mm-hmm. It really is. Thank you, Wanda. Thank you very, very much. And thank you, Lantine and Ryan.
Thank you.
All right. Well, you all take good care. And again, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, Wanda. See you at the theater.
Definitely. Peace and blessings.
Okay. Bye-bye. Peace and blessings. Bye-bye.
Bye. So we're going to close out this morning. Oh, my goodness. I am so, flustered here right at the moment. I was thinking about playing something from Liz Wright, because it's raining right now in the San Francisco Bay Area, in the East Bay specifically. And I was thinking about playing something by her, Lynn Wright. And so I'm scrolling, looking for that particular song. So hold tight. Yeah. Oh, we had a really wonderful, wonderful program this morning. I hope everyone was able to catch all of it. And thanks for sticking through the technical difficulties, which were kind of crazy. I don't see Lynn Wright. Darn. So we're going to play something else. Until I find it, I scroll past. I think we're going to play we're going to play On a Day Like Today by Megli Todaro, which I really like a lot. And I like Megli and Quinn's Look at What the Light Did. Yeah, I think we're going to play Look at What the Light Did by McLean and Quinn, which I really like a lot as well. And while I look for Lynn Wright's play something from her.
Upon the peak, oh, look at what the light is now.
put a spell on you, because your mind, you better stop it, Daddy. You better stop doing the things you do. I lie. Well, 'cause I can't stand it. All of you fooling around. Well, I can't stand it, baby. Don't you ever try to put me down. I'm gonna put a spell on you.
Where you are. You can't find it in a whisper. You can't find it in a shout, no. You can't find it in a schoolyard, darling. Sing about it in a church house. Look out now. I said truth, that's hard to hide. You know truth, somewhere deep inside. You know truth, can change your mind. And truth, you make it in disguise.
On You, Kim Nally sings Nina Simone, and McLeading Quinn started out this musical conclusion of a wonderful show this Friday, April 25th, 2014. Look at what the light did now. And we're going to conclude as we began with a song about the earth. We started with a little excerpt of Alice Walker singing about the planet. We're going to conclude with Sweet Honey and the Rock performing their classic Battered Earth.
If the earth could fly away, could you see her flying straight through space and time, leaving all humankind behind? If she could fly away, if she could fly away, so far away. If the earth could run away, could you see her gathering all the trees and plants, all the animals, all the birds and fowl, every creeping thing? They have never been her foe, never harmed her blessed soul. If she could run away, if she could run away, so far away, then she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for her blessed life. Oh, she'd be running for life. She'd be running for her life, running for her blessed life. If the earth could up and walk away, could you see her causing foam? All the oceans and the seas, all the rivers and the streams, all the whales and fish, every reptile that exists, they have never been her foe, never harmed
She'd be running for life, running for life.